Some of you know that I had the chance to tour the Holy Land a few weeks ago. I spent 12 days in Israel and the West Bank and had a great time. But there were a few surprises during our time there. There was a group of about 40 of us ministry leaders, and our trip leader, who's done this trip numerous times, planned some surprises. And one night, we got back to our hotel after going to a number of sites, and he said that after dinner, we were going to have a surprise. And we didn't know what was in store for us. And the last time he had said that, we ended up riding camels. So you know, we thought, wow, who knows what's coming? But this was a different sort of surprise. We finished dinner and went to a meeting room in the hotel. And the surprise was a couple of guest speakers. Our leader had some connections in the area, and he invited these two men to come. And they got there at slightly separate times. I watched them walk in. And when they greeted one another, it was clear that they were very close friends. You know, they embraced one another the way that old friends do. As they were waiting for us to finish a few housekeeping details, they were joking around and slapping each other on the back. And I thought, I don't know who these guys are, but they're very close. I was surprised then to learn who they were. Our leader introduced them, and one of the men, you can see their picture here, on the right there is an Israeli Jewish man whose family has lived in Jerusalem for a number of generations. The man on the left there is a Palestinian Muslim man who was born and raised in the West Bank. Now, you don't have to be an expert in international relations to know that Israeli Jews and Palestinian Muslims don't tend to get along. And so I was curious, wow, how do these men know one another? Why are they so close? How did this happen? And all 40 of us sat there on the edge of our seats as they told their story. The Israeli man started, and he told us about how his 14-year-old daughter died because Palestinian suicide bombers set off a bomb outside of her school. And then the Palestinian man came and told us about how his 10-year-old daughter was killed by an Israeli border guard who shot her. And the men told us that their bond was the pain that they shared. They had met one another right around the time that they both suffered a loss. And somehow they had decided that, unlike what had been the case in so many people before, they were not going to let this pain perpetuate the animosity that exists, that they were going to let it be something different. And they talked about how ever since, for about 10 years now, they've made it their life's mission to communicate that reconciliation begins when we listen to one another's pain. When they finished telling their story, we all had tears in our eyes. We were inspired by what we had heard. They had one last thing to say before they left us. And what they said was, "So what? Now that you've heard our story, what difference is it going to make? Is it just going to be a nice, inspiring story? Or is it going to somehow change the way you live? Are you going to act on it?" And I've been thinking about that question ever since. I think it's a question that we're faced with today. We're all here because of an inspiring story. A story that begins with the agony of death and culminates with redemption. The Easter story that Jesus is risen. I think we need to answer the question, so what? If Easter really happened, if Jesus really rose from the dead, is it just an inspiring story, or is it going to make some kind of difference in our lives? And I want to wrestle with that question for our time together today and basically come at it from three angles. One is, what does the resurrection say to our minds? And two, what does it do for our hearts? And then three, how does it shape the purpose of our lives? We've been going through a sermon series since January called Coming Into Focus. We've been walking through the Gospel of Mark in the New Testament from start to finish, trying to get a clear picture of who Jesus is. And my hope for you today, whether you've been with us the whole time or even if you're just dropping in today, my hope is that the resurrection of Jesus will come into clear focus for you. What it means for your life. You want to have a Bible open as we look at the story and pull out a few of the details there. It's at the end of Mark 15, the beginning of Mark 16. And if you don't have a Bible with you, you can take the one from the chair in front of you and find this on page 1588. Of course, you're always welcome to use the Bible app on your phone if you have that. the end of Mark 15 and the beginning of Mark 16. And when we drop into the story today, Jesus is dead. A wealthy member of the Jewish ruling council, a man named Joseph of Arimathea, who was a secret follower of Jesus, had been there when Jesus died on Friday afternoon, and he wanted to give Jesus a proper Jewish burial. So he went to the Roman governor, Pilate, who was in charge of the crucifixion, and he asked for permission to bury Jesus' body. Now, the crucifixion of Jesus took place on the top of a rocky hill just outside the city walls of Jerusalem. It was actually a rock quarry where they had taken out lots of rock for building purposes. Everything in that area is made from stone. You had to get it from somewhere, and they had quarried all this rock. And the top of this little hill, was the stone was too hard. They couldn't remove it. That's where Jesus was crucified. But the areas around the base of that hill where the rock had been carved out, it left these cavernous spaces, almost like man-made caves, which were turned into tombs. They were tombs for wealthy people who could afford to buy them. Historians have discovered about 1,000 of these first century tombs in and around Jerusalem. We saw some of them when we were there a few weeks ago. And they had several little niches inside of them, kind of benches or areas where several bodies could be laid. So it would be a family tomb. This is the outside of one of those tombs to give you a sense for what it might have looked like. You can see the opening and the circular stone there. There would be a notch in the ground that stone would slip into. They would use that wooden beam as kind of a lever to move it out of the way and then to put it back. And we have another picture there, I think, of somebody going in just so you can get a sense of perspective for the size of that opening. But this tomb is not this one in the picture, but the one in the story was for Joseph of Arimathea's family. Nobody was buried there yet. And the custom in those days for Jewish people was that they would cover a dead body with perfumes and spices. And the reason was that you never know if you might have to open the tomb back up in a few days or a couple of weeks to bury somebody else. And it was a practical way of minimizing the odor of a decaying body. Now, the hang-up for Jesus' body was that when he died, it was late afternoon Friday, right before sunset. And for Jewish people, the Sabbath starts Friday at sunset. And this was an extra special Sabbath, being Passover. So the job of covering his body with perfumes and spices couldn't be completed because the Sabbath started. And so fast forward to Sunday morning, and we have several of the women who have been following Jesus for his whole ministry, and they're going to finish the job of putting the perfumes and the spices on Jesus' body. And when they're on the way to the tomb, all they can think about is, how are we going to get in? There's this massive stone in front of it. We're not strong enough to move it. When they get there, they're surprised to find that it's already been done. The stone is out of the way. And being surprised, they walk right in and they look to the right. We walked into one of these tombs a few weeks ago and look, there's actually a bench, or I guess it's a shelf kind of area here. And they looked right over to that area and there was an angelic being, a bright young man who spoke to them, and they are startled. Now look at what the angel says to them in verse 6. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him." Now, this angel is bringing a message from Jesus for the women. And he is inviting them to see for themselves, to look with their own eyes and see Jesus is not here. Now, the reason this is important is that Mark, if you look back at chapter 15, verse 47, Mark says that Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of Joseph, saw where he was laid. They were with Joseph on Friday afternoon when Joseph put Jesus in that very spot. And the wording in verse 47 is almost the exact same wording in the original language as verse 6 of chapter 16. And Mark is trying to catch our attention to show us these women were there when Jesus' dead body was put there. They know this is the right spot, and now the angel is saying, look, here he was. He's not there anymore. See for yourselves. And this is where I think that the resurrection gives us an invitation for our minds. It's an invitation to use your intellect and see for yourself that Jesus is alive. See, I would bet that some of you don't really think that Jesus rose from the dead. We tend to be very rational people, and it's easy to think, well, you know, resurrection is a nice symbol, a nice metaphor, kind of like winter giving way to spring. Death gives way to life. It's beautiful, but come on, dead people don't get up from the grave. Or maybe you think it was kind of just a spiritual resurrection. Jesus' spirit lived on, but his body, of course, didn't come back to life. Maybe you want it to be true, but your mind just can't accept that it would actually happen. And I think that just like the angel invited the women to see for themselves, Jesus would give you the invitation to use your intellect and see for yourself. Investigate. It's very reasonable to believe that Jesus really rose from the dead. And I want to just take a few minutes to give you some of the reasons that we can believe that with confidence. I'm not going to hit them all for time's sake. I'm just going to give you a few facts to think about. One is the fact of the personal names that Mark mentions here in his account. Chapter 16, verse 1, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, Salome. He mentions them back in chapter 15, verse 40, I believe, and also verse 47. Now, if you were to read the commentaries about this passage, and I read several of them in the last few weeks, all the commentators say that Mark does something unusual here. Throughout his whole book, he hasn't really given a lot of attention to personal names. But suddenly, at the end of chapter 15 and the beginning of chapter 16, he uses personal names and he uses them redundantly, specifically with these women. He names them three times in a short succession of verses. Why does he do that? It's because this was the first century way of documenting history. This is the way of saying, hey, these women who saw this happen, they're still alive. If you don't believe, go ask them yourself. They'll tell you it really happened. It was kind of like an ancient footnote. Ever since I came to Three Village Church about 6 years ago, I've been hearing people tell the story of how our church first came into being. And the details change a little bit here and there, but the core of the story is always the same, depending on who I hear it from. That there are a few women in Stony Brook who saw the need for a church that would consistently teach the good news of Jesus. And they really wanted to see that happen, so they started a church in their living room. It hit me a few months ago as we're gearing up for the 60th anniversary of our church in May that the main driver of that event is still alive. And I could go hear the story myself. Her name's Mary Ward, and she lives in Arlington, Texas at an assisted living facility. So in February, I went to Texas, was there for a wedding, and I drove over to Arlington on a Sunday afternoon, and I saw Mariel in her living room. And she's about 90 years old, but her mind is still sharp. And she recounted the story more vividly than anybody I've ever heard tell it. She laughed as she told me, you know, there really wasn't anything super spiritual about it. We just saw a need, and me and a couple other women, we decided to meet it. And I'm like, you go, girl, that's the way. She said, listen to this. The only advertisement we did was to contact one paper. There was no social media, of course. We contacted the Three Village Times Herald. We put one ad that said, church meeting, such and such living room this Sunday, and 25 people showed up. They could barely fit in the living room. And the rest is history. But I tell you that because that's what Mark is doing here by listing these personal names over and over. He was writing his gospel about 30 years after Jesus' resurrection, around 65 AD. And these witnesses, these women were still alive. Now, 30 years, that's only half the time of how long our church has been in existence. So you can see how easy it would be to go and talk to somebody who saw it happen. Mark is saying, listen, if this didn't happen, go ask for yourselves. They'll tell you. And if it was false that Jesus was alive, you know what would have happened? History would have debunked the claim of a resurrection. It would never have survived the first century, but it did because it really happened. There's the fact of these personal names. But then there's also the fact of women as witnesses. Now, some of you have heard this before, but this is really important. So I'm going to describe it again. If you read all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, as they tell the resurrection story, they're looking from four different angles. And so you're going to get a few differing details. But one thing that's there in all four accounts is that the first witnesses to see the empty tomb and see Jesus alive were women. Now, why does that matter? Well, in the first century world, women were not considered to be equal with men. They didn't have any dignity. They weren't thought to be believable. It was thought that they were impulsive liars. So they were not allowed to testify in any legal matters. Now, think about this for a moment. If you were a follower of Jesus and you knew he died and he didn't really rise from the dead, but you want the movement to live on, and so you decide you're going to steal his body, get rid of it somehow, and create some documents that will support your movement living on, and you've got to really write the story so that it's very believable. Who are you going to say saw him alive? Who saw the empty tomb? You're going to pick the most credible witnesses around. And who would that be? That would be the male religious leaders. You wouldn't say that women were the witnesses because nobody would believe you. You would only say it that way if that's exactly how it happened. And all four Gospels tell us that because it really happened. And women really were the ones to find Jesus alive. And if you think about it, knowing Jesus, it shouldn't surprise us because he's always been treating women with dignity. He's always been relating with them as disciples who are on an equal plane with men. And where were the men in this story? They're hiding out because they're afraid. They're nowhere to be found. It's the women who stay at the cross to the very end. It's the women who show up at the tomb. And it's the women who first see that Jesus is alive. There's the fact of the personal names, the fact of the women as witnesses. But then there's also the fact of changed disciples. Speaking of the men, when was the last time we saw these 12 male disciples? Well, Judas, we last saw him betraying Jesus for money. He was greedy. Now he's out of the picture. And then there was Peter, kind of the head. And the last time we saw him, he denied three times that he had ever even met Jesus. And then John probably hung around till the end with the ladies. But the other 10, they're hiding out in a locked room trying to figure out how they're going to put their lives back together. Because this whole Jesus thing must have been a farce if he's dead. And so they're thinking, we got to go back up north to Galilee, get a job again, wipe the shame off of our faces, hope people will accept us. And yet within about a month's time, they did a 180-degree turnaround. They went from hiding out, being cowards, to courageously preaching that Jesus is alive. Peter, the one who denied Jesus, in about a month's time, he's going to stand up in Jerusalem, the very city that crucified Jesus, in front of thousands of people, some of whom were the ones that killed Jesus. And he's going to proclaim, Jesus is alive, and you can be changed by believing in him. And thousands of people would believe. Why? Because many of them were around. They could check it out for themselves. Jesus was really alive. These other 10 disciples, as far as we can tell, all but one would die as a direct result of preaching that message that Jesus is alive, we saw him, we touched him, you can be changed by believing in him. What made the difference? How did they go from being cowardly to courageous? The difference is that they interacted with him after he rose from the dead. And it gives us good reason to believe that it really happened. Just one more fact for you to think about with your mind, and it's the fact of an empty tomb. The fact of an empty tomb. Jerusalem in those days was, by our standards, a fairly small town. Relatively, it was large, but very compact, enclosed by a city wall. It was hard for there to be secrets. Everybody heard everything. There were watchtowers on the walls at the corner of the city where soldiers were watching at all hours. There were soldiers stationed outside the tomb. And when these women get there in the morning, there's no body in the tomb. Now, if you were one of the religious leaders who crucified Jesus and this hoax has arisen that he's alive and you wanted to disprove it, what would you do? You would go get the body and say, hey, folks, this is false. We have a body. It would shut the whole thing down. But nobody ever found the body. Some people say, well, the disciples stole the body. Great. What about the soldiers watching from the watchtowers? What about the soldiers right outside the tomb? How would they pull it off? There was no body. The tomb was empty. And it's good reason to believe that Jesus really rose from the dead. And I think this story gives you the invitation, even the challenge today, to use your intellect and investigate the resurrection for yourself. The best way I know to do that is to come to Alpha. We've mentioned it already. You can come on Thursday night, have a nice dinner, listen to a little bit of a teaching video, and then spend some time wrestling with the questions you have. It's a safe space. No questions are off limits. Reason is valued. And you have a great time, I think, if you came. We're also going to start a new sermon series 2 weeks from today, May the 12th. I think that's 2 weeks. It's going to be called The Trouble with Christianity. We're going to be looking at some of the biggest roadblocks to believing that the Christian faith is true. And if you're someone who has a lot of questions, I would encourage you to be here and be part of that so that you can use your mind and wrestle through some of those things. It's an invitation for our minds. But secondly, I also think there are some of you here who believe the resurrection happened, and yet your heart hasn't really been changed by it. And I think that today the resurrection is an encouragement for your heart. Maybe it has changed you before, yet you need it to encourage you again today. And there are two specific areas where I think that the resurrection can do this for your heart. One has to do with your fear. Some of you live with fear every day. For some of you, it's the fear of death, your own death. For some of you, it's the fear of losing somebody. But it paralyzes you. I remember interacting with a woman some years ago through an Alpha course. She had come the first 7 weeks of Alpha, and at two-thirds of the way through the course, we take a little retreat. We were on the retreat. Her name is Amy. She was about 60 years old. She came to me at the end of that retreat, and she said, "Pastor Josh, until today, I can't remember a single day in my life where I wasn't terrified. I was living with fear at every moment. Today is the first day in my life where I haven't felt fear." And I said, "What made the difference?" She said, "Now I know Jesus is alive and he loves me." And if you've been plagued with fear, the resurrection means that that doesn't have to be the case for you anymore. But it doesn't just happen. You see, in this story, there's fear all over the place. The women are afraid as they go to the tomb. They're afraid when they see the angel. Even after they see the empty tomb, as they're running off, they're afraid. They don't want to interact with anybody because they're afraid of what will happen. And they've seen the best evidence. They've seen the empty tomb. But you see, just seeing the evidence for yourself doesn't necessarily take away your fear. It requires a personal interaction with Jesus. It requires working out the implications for your own heart. And if you take the time to do this, I think you'll see that if Jesus could overcome the grave, then even our greatest enemy doesn't have a hold on us. Death doesn't have the last word anymore. And you're going to see more about why that's the case when we close in just a little bit. But the other area that I think that the resurrection can encourage your heart has to do with failure. Have you ever gotten halfway through a project and thought, "Wow, I got to start this over. This is a mess." When my wife and I were expecting our first child almost 15 years ago, I decided I wanted to make a toy box for our children. Now, I had not a clue about woodworking, all right? There was no YouTube. You couldn't go figure out how somebody else has done it and watch the video. I guess I just had a lot of extra time on my hands relative to now. And so I went to Home Depot, bought some wood, got a circular saw, some wood glue, and thought I would just figure it out. And I invested hours into that, and I couldn't get the thing to stay together. And I just had to start over and over and over. I couldn't finally, I went and bought lots of screws, and that thing had a lot of metal in it by the time I finished. And because of all the metal, it's still standing today somehow. But I think that a lot of us get well into a project called life, and we wish we could start over. Maybe because of the way that someone has wounded you. Maybe because of decisions that you've made yourself. I got an email from a pastor this week who shared the story of a woman who just went through a divorce. And she said she feels like she has to spend the rest of her life sitting in a penalty box, to use hockey terms. You ever felt that way? And if you're someone who's plagued by failure, the resurrection is a word of grace for you. That's not my phrase. That's James Edwards is a commentator who wrote about Mark's gospel. And he says that in the angel's message, we see a word of grace. I want you to see that. It's in verse 7 when the angel speaks to the women. "But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." Now think about this for a moment. The message that Jesus gives through the angel for the disciples is, "I still have a plan for you. I still want to do something great with your life. And in fact, I'm going to go ahead of you and make it possible for you to be part of this thing once again. Now think about what Jesus could have said. You tell those backstabbing cowards that if they want to have anything to do with me, they had better get on their knees and beg. Right? Because they had abandoned him. They had failed him. And that's not what he says. Now think about Peter in particular. You know, it struck me this week that the angel says, tell the disciples and Peter. Sounds redundant. Why name Peter separately? It's because Peter's failure was the worst. He had abandoned Jesus. He had denied knowing him. And if Peter's with the disciples and the women come back and say, hey, Jesus is alive. He wants to meet the disciples up in Galilee. You know what Peter's going to think? That doesn't include me anymore. I screwed up too bad. Jesus can't use me. He's just talking to the others. And so Jesus, through the angel, specifically names Peter. Tell the disciples and Peter that I'm going ahead of them and I still have a plan for them. And not only does Jesus have a plan to include Peter, what's Jesus' plan for Peter? He's going to be the leader of the whole movement that's going to change the world. How does that work? I love the way that Tim Keller, another pastor, described this. He said, because Peter's screw-up was the biggest, his repentance will be the deepest, and his grasp of grace will be the greatest, and that will make him the most qualified person to be a leader in Jesus' movement. Isn't that just how Jesus works? You see, Jesus is different from every other leader and every other movement in the world. Every other religion says, I am useful to God, I am accepted by God, insofar as I perform morally. Insofar as I keep the rules and I honor God, God can bless me, God can use me, but if I fail, well, I'm out. But that's not what Jesus says. Jesus says you're validated not by being strong, but by admitting how weak you are, by acknowledging your failure. Keller goes on to explain this. He says, if you let your failure drive you into the gospel, it becomes a resurrection. The gospel says you're saved not by your work and your past, but by Christ's work and Christ's past. See, if you understand how flawed you are and how the death of Jesus paid for all of your failures, then you're in a perfect position for him to pick you up and give you a significant part in his life-changing movement in the world. If he was willing to use Peter, the biggest screw-up, he certainly is able to use you. And why does this word of grace come at the resurrection? It's because the resurrection proves that what Jesus did on the cross was enough to take away all of your sin and all of your failure. Think about this analogy. Imagine a man who commits armed robbery. He gets convicted. He goes to jail. He serves every day of a 20-year sentence. When he comes out, you ask him something, ask him to give a comment. What's he going to say? He's going to say, my debt to society is paid. I just paid it every day, 20 years. And the law holds no more claim over him. When Jesus walks out of the tomb alive, that is God stamping across all of history. It is paid in full. What Jesus did on the cross was enough. I've accepted the payment. You're free. Your failure no longer has any claim on you. The resurrection is a word of encouragement for your heart. Work it into your heart. Lastly, I think there are some of you here who believe that the resurrection happened. You've allowed it to get into your heart, and yet it hasn't really shaped what you live for. If Jesus really did rise from the dead, if he really overcame death, if he overcame our failure, the very best purpose that you could give your life to is sharing this good news with as many people as possible. You know, I think that for most of us, what we're driven by, what we think about, what we value, what we live for, is not much different from the rest of the world. The things that we really value, really cling to are, making a good living, having enough money to buy some nice things, having a nice house, keeping our family safe, keeping ourselves safe, being secure. And why is it that those are the things that drive us the same as everybody else? Well, it's because of our fear. It's because we think that what we have now, this body, these relationships, this material world, that's all we have. If something happens to one of those things, it gets taken away, that's it. We don't have anything else, and we're afraid of what it would be to lose our present existence or this world or someone who we love. But understand what the resurrection of Jesus says. When he walks out of the tomb in a body, not just a spirit, he's saying, I value bodies. I value the material world. And everything that you lose in this life, you get back in a perfected way. You don't have to be afraid of losing it. Take a look at this picture. Just ignore Kim and me. Do you have any idea what beach that is we're standing on? It's the beach on the Sea of Galilee where historians think Jesus surprised the disciples after his resurrection. Remember, he said through the angel, tell them to meet me in Galilee. And in John's Gospel, chapter 21, he tells us about that meeting. This is one of my favorite places that we saw. That's why I took a picture here. Because what happened is that some of the disciples went back up to Galilee where they were from. They went fishing overnight. They didn't catch anything. And in the morning, when the sun comes up, they look over on the shore and they see a figure in the distance. They're not sure who it is. But the person calls out, hey, did you catch anything? And they're honest fishermen. All the fishermen I know would have lied. They said, no, we haven't caught anything. And Jesus says, well, throw your net on the other side of the boat. Should have been a dead giveaway who it was. They do. They catch a net full of fish. And then they realize it's Jesus on the shore. And they race over to meet him because they haven't had much time with him yet since he rose from the grave. And when they get to the beach, they see that Jesus has a campfire going. There's some bread staying warm over the fire. He's got a couple of fish. He says, hey, guys, throw some of your fish on the fire. They stay on the beach. They have lox and bagels together, sort of. Enjoy a good breakfast. Jesus takes Peter for a walk by the sea. He makes sure Peter understands that Jesus has forgiven him. Do you understand what Jesus is showing them and showing us by doing this, by cooking fish on a fire by the sea with his friends after the resurrection? He's showing us that the resurrected Jesus values bodies and food and fishing and friendships and hugs and laughter and walks by the seaside, which means by implication that he hates loneliness and separation and damage to the environment and poverty and sickness. And we see this concept get developed in the rest of the New Testament, that Jesus' resurrection body and what he does with it is a prototype for ours. It's a picture of what we get to look forward to when he comes back and he gives us new bodies and he makes a new material earth. He makes it all new. For every other religion, salvation is escape from the body, escape from the material world. But for Jesus, salvation is not escape, but renewal. Everything gets perfected. Everything that we've lost gets made new. And if we understand that, you know what it does? It releases us from fear. We can take calculated risks for him because this is not all we have. And it gives us a purpose worth living for. Because if he values relationships and food and health and the material world, and one day he's going to make it all new, that means we can devote our energy, our lives to those things that he values. We can fight the things that he hates, knowing that ultimately he wins. Do you see? The resurrection changes everything. So what will Easter mean for you today, this week, this year? Will you take some time and use your mind to look into it and see how reasonable it is? Will you work its implications into your heart? Let it release you from fear and failure. Will you let it shape the purpose that you live for? Or will it just be a nice, inspiring story that you hear once a year? The resurrection changes everything. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we praise you that the grave could not hold you. We praise you that what you did on the cross was enough to take away all of our sin, that we don't have to go on carrying our guilt. We praise you that you've released us from fear. Lord, I know that there are many of us in the room today who are having a hard time letting that affect our hearts. Some of us are still plagued with fear. Some of us are plagued with grief. There are some here who can't imagine how they'll get up in the morning and go through the motions. And I pray that your Spirit would be speaking to each one of them in this moment, showing them how the fact that you are alive changes everything. Jesus, you are our living hope, and we want to live for you. We pray in your name. Amen.